I'm Christopher Ludden. This is Open Source. We are learning that the Singapore summit caught the attention of the real public and private Donald Trump.
They have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? I said, boy, look at that. Wouldn't that make a great condo behind? And I explained, I said, you know, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there. Think of it from a real estate perspective.
If there were a simple sports score, who won, who lost, between Mr. Trump and Mr. Kim, we wouldn't believe the scorekeepers anyway. Imagine if it were Barack Obama going face-to-face with Kim Jong-un for a denuclearized Korea. Would Rachel Maddow not be swooning? And the Fox guys would surely be saying Obama got snookered. But then, if Donald Trump had negotiated the no nukes for Iran deal, wouldn't Sean Hannity still be crowing at the sheer mastery of it? When politics gets so personal and so poisonous, we take refuge in the long view this hour. It's year 72 of the nuclear age. Where are we really, and where are we going? Our guides this hour are historians of different sorts. The diplomat Chaz Freeman lived it as translator between Richard Nixon and Chairman Mao in the breakthrough talks of 1972. Gene Gilliman has written the germ warfare horror story from the 1930s, which East Asia does not forget. The novelist James Carroll is reimagining our own American bomb dilemma since the 40s. And Richard Rhodes won all the big prizes for his three-volume nuclear history. Ambassador Chaz Freeman leads the way. I put it to him, why did attitude and atmosphere feel so critical in Singapore after the false starts between North Korea and the Bushes, Bill Clinton, and President Obama?
President Trump addressed the intentions of the North Koreans at Singapore, not their capabilities. It's a typical military worst-case approach to assume that if the other side has capabilities, you must impute the worst of all motives to them, and that's easy to do in the case of the North Koreans. But in the real world, you know, the French could strike us with nuclear weapons at any moment. So could the British. And we don't worry about that because it's clear that they have no reason to do that, no intention to do that. What President Trump tried to do was take away the reason for the North Koreans to possibly strike the United States with nuclear weapons. And for better or ill, he succeeded, at least for a while. As he said, there is no reason now to worry that North Korea is going to attack the United States. It has no reason to do so while the process that was begun at Singapore continues to unfold.
Why didn't others see that?
You know, one of the criticisms of the previous approach was that it treated North Korea like a nuclear problem instead of a country. Mr. Trump is all about attitudes, feelings, personalities. He's not a statesman in the normal sense. And he treated this as a question of attitudes, as you said.
One has a sense that Kim Jong-un knows what he's doing here. Can you map his plan?
I think Kim Jong-un realized that to assure regime survival, which is his supreme objective, he needed to change the environment. He did this in two ways. First, he developed a credible nuclear deterrent against any attempt by the United States at regime change. And with that behind him, with the confidence that he had successfully deterred the United States, he then turned to making peace with South Korea. I think his strategy has very clearly been to remove the causes of a possible war against his country. And by working with South Korea to release resources for economic reform and change in his country. As soon as Mr. Moon and Mr. Kim met, they became the center of the entire process, not the Trump-Kim meeting so much as the Moon-Kim meeting, and the process it started will decide whether there is, in fact, at some point, denuclearization in Korea. Because the prerequisite for that now has become rapprochement, peace, détente, reduced tensions, perhaps mutually balanced force reductions between South and North Korea, such that war becomes less and less probable and ultimately unthinkable.
Chaz, you're making it sound very plausible, very possible, or at least real.
What Mr. Trump did, obviously, was in part, maybe in large part, directed at a show for the benefit of his constituency in the midterm elections. He has garnered additional support in the United States by this performance. He's left a lot of people, including U.S. allies like Japan, bemused or perhaps even concerned about where this is all going. But meetings between South and North Korea are now ongoing, and their purpose is to try to implement or develop the peace treaty that President Moon Jae-in and Chairman Kim discuss at their two summits, and to see whether they can find a basis for reducing military tensions. Mr. Kim destroyed a missile test facility, or at least said he would. And that, of course, directly reduces the danger to the United States. It's more than a change in attitude. At least for the time being, there's also a change in the physical threat.
The scholar of North Korea, marvelous man in Chicago named Bruce Cummings, says it's actually old wisdom in Korea. Going back to 1880, the Chinese ambassador said, here's my advice, stay close to China, associate with Japan, but ally with America. That was 1880, and it sounds like the plan, the Kim Jong-un plan today.
Well, it's certainly very closely related. I think North Korea feels that it is overly dependent on China. It's uncomfortable because it's next to China. If it can work out a basis for peaceful coexistence with South Korea, then the two Koreas together can resume the position of neutrality that you just described Bruce Cummings' advice.
This summit, this deal, such as it is getting a horrible press in the United States. Address this mainstream, almost blanket no.
Well, in one sense, it is a manifestation of the extent to which our thinking about the world has become militarized. We don't really practice diplomacy normally. This was a very unconventional exercise in diplomacy directed at changing intentions, not capabilities. So it's just very foreign to American thinking. We have a military-industrial congressional complex which is deeply committed to the warfare state. This goes against that entire ethos. We have what some have unkindly called the blob, meaning a suffocating unanimity of national security thinking in Washington, which is entirely unconvinced by Mr. Trump and his approach to world affairs and inclined to condemn him, and which naturally doesn't like something that goes against the essential militarism of the American posture internationally.
What about the sense that all of this means a diminished standing of the United States in the Western Pacific?
Well, the reality is that the United States entered Korea. After all, the war began between Koreans. But the United States entered it to defend the perimeter of our sphere of influence against that of the Soviet Union.
Right, containment.
This was the beginning of the Cold War. It was international from our point of view. We were trying to block any breakout from containment of what we saw as the Sino-Soviet bloc. But the Sino-Soviet bloc disappeared, and then the Soviet Union itself disappeared. Its sphere of influence disappeared, and yet we're still in Korea. So the question Mr. Trump implicitly is asking is why? What difference in terms of American interests does it make if we're there or not? And if South Korea and North Korea can make peace, aren't we better off? So I think that is the reasoning here. It might fail. Mr. Trump has not committed the United States to withdraw from Korea. The Chinese, I should add, withdrew in 1959, almost 60 years ago, so we're a little bit slow in that regard. But he hasn't committed us to withdraw, and should his diplomacy fail, it's entirely open to him to remain in Korea. What is now very, very unlikely, what is almost unthinkable, is for us to start a war. Fire and fury, as Mr. Trump threatens, is off the table, for now at least.
Does Kim Jong-un know he's negotiating with Donald Trump himself, not the United States or the United States government or United States opinion even?
I think he does. I think the entirely original approach, flattering Kim Jong-un, giving him the prestige he needs to overcome domestic opposition, whether from the military and security forces or from the state enterprises, to carry out economic reform, to relax tensions with South Korea, to invite Korean and South Korean and Chinese investment, to work with the United States rather than against us, to reposition North Korea between the United States and China. All these things are perhaps desirable from Mr. Kim's point of view, but they all have enemies inside North Korea.
Hmm. Try to sum it up, and looking at the whole map, what's working here? Where are we going?
We're no longer headed toward war. We're headed toward a possible peace in Korea. That's something we should be grateful for.
And what, if anything, connects Donald Trump's mind and ambition back toward Iran and that nuclear deal?
Well, I think there are several implications of this. One is with Iran. Mr. Trump has already made it clear that he hopes to open a negotiation with the Iranians. I suppose if he takes the same approach, the Iranians might actually welcome that. The other implication, however, is a more somber one. If you want to get the attention of the United States, if you want recognition from the United States, you have to develop the capacity to hit American cities with nuclear weapons. If you do that, the U.S. will take you seriously and make concessions to your interests. If you just menace U.S. allies, the U.S. will be agitated, but will not make concessions.
Chaz Freeman, you are our translator to the world, our Secretary of State. We're so grateful always to hear from you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be asked to speak. Thank you.
Coming up, the original American argument and indecision around nuclear weapons that set in before Hiroshima had cooled down. This is Open Source. Our friend, the prolific James Carroll, has a new novel out this spring called The Cloister. But he also, at the same time, gave himself a creative writing assignment in Trump time, which became dope out the backstory of the distemper that elected our president and write the story. Turns out to be a play titled Midnight Ride, referring not just to Paul Revere's, but to the doomsday clock ticking in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which has been advanced at the start of 2018 to 2 minutes before the midnight of nuclear devastation. Jim, I got to know also, out of your non-fictional history of the Pentagon called House of War, you have resurfaced an old argument among real giants of the 20th century, in Washington anyway, post-World War II. Imagine, it's 1945 again, Jim, and the question is what to do with those nuclear weapons and the nuclear secrets.
Well, Chris, first, thanks for inviting me to be part of this conversation. The most authoritative voice on this subject in 1945, a person who's forgotten by and large by the general public, was Secretary of War Henry Stimson, who had presided over the war.
Amazing character.
For 5 years, the brutal conflict of World War II, as he is made to say in the play I've written, every military order went on in his under his signature, including the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And astonishingly, in September of 1945, almost exactly 1 month after the Japanese surrender, Stimson put before President Truman, as it happened on the date of September 11th, 1945, a proposal to Truman that the United Nations, the United States immediately begin to move to put its atomic bomb under the control of an international body, the soon-to-be-established United Nations. It was already in sight. Stimson saw the United Nations as the perfect custodian for this weapon, which he regarded as a weapon apart and if we don't submit our atomic arsenal to international control, every other nation, especially the Soviet Union, will have a motive to pursue it, and leading to what he called a disastrous arms race. And he foresaw it. Simpson's vision of the coming future was crystal clear. The Secretary of War, Chris, put this proposal to Truman. Truman put it before his cabinet. The cabinet debated it seriously. To Truman's credit, he took this proposal seriously enough to have it. And the cabinet was divided, but even a realpolitik figure like Dean Acheson supported Stimson's
Stimson,
proposal.
I got to say, we should all get reacquainted with Stimson. I know him for two wonderful aphorisms. As to eavesdropping, I mean, to wiretapping, he famously said, "Gentlemen, do not read other gentlemen's mail."
Yes.
But the other one, the classic, and I didn't connect it to this question you're talking about, was how do you make a man trustworthy?
Yes.
Well, answer: trust him.
Yes, and that,
even Stalin in this case.
That famous line of Stimson's was exactly in the proposal to Truman on September 11, 1945. Now, the reason this is important is what Stimson was basically foreseeing was the only way to control nuclear weapons is by a process of international agreement, international trust but verify, international,
yes,
international controls where every nation submits in this one realm to the possibility of collaboration with other nations. Now, the disarmament process that began in earnest in 1963 with the first arms control agreement, President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which began this regime of disarmament treaties coming through the 1968 Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty right up through President Obama's New START Treaty. This process of negotiation, which actually consisted of nations accepting some kind of international control, inspection, verification, this is what saved the world from the nuclear holocaust, this process. Stimson foresaw it in 45. Alas, the United States would not see it until the nightmare of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the capacity of the human species to destroy itself was made vivid, palpable, clear. And I would suggest it didn't become comparably clear again until last summer, when we had the rhetoric of fire and fury, when we had two nuclear chieftains playing chicken with each other. And it's only by an act of moral luck that what was underway last summer, don't forget that last July, while President Trump, whose name I swore I wouldn't use tonight, was threatening North Korea, he was also meeting with his nuclear priests in the Pentagon and calling on them in July of last summer to reestablish Cold War levels of our nuclear arsenal.
And meantime, the United Nations was voting. Go ahead.
Well, at the same time, the United Nations is pleading for a banning of the nuclear weapons. It was, by the way, Trump's ignorant and offhand call for a return to nuclear levels of the Cold War that prompted Secretary of State Tillerson, allegedly, to call him a moron. Look, we've just been through a chapter of moral luck, because it was very clear to people last year, which prompted, I think, the kind of urgency of the last month, that we were on a precipice again. The point, of course, is that we've been on that precipice for 70 years. We just have only occasionally reckoned with it. The presence of nuclear weapons in the arsenals of the world, now only 9 nations, but if things go as they seem to be going, within 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, it will be 10, 20, 30, 40 nations with nuclear weapons. And as President Obama said in Prague, his great abolition speech, we all know where that leads. It leads to the extinction of the human species. That's what it's at stake here. And I would just finally say one other thing about President Trump. It isn't just his unpredictability, the inflammatory rhetoric. He's establishing policies that are going to haunt us for a good long while further into the future. Last summer, the Pentagon was preparing its 2018 nuclear posture review when the Defense Department describes its attitude toward nuclear weapons. The 2018 nuclear posture review, published in the early months of this year, reversed the 2010 nuclear posture review, again from the Pentagon, which looked forward to the end of nuclear weapons under President Obama. The Pentagon itself embraced the idea of abolition. That's what's crucial here. The 2018 nuclear posture review talked about the reinvention of nuclear weapons, introducing a whole new set of nuclear weapons on into the open-ended future. It's a catastrophe unfolding.
You know it so much better than I do, Jim, but is there not a bipartisan blob on this subject? And did not President Obama sign off on $1 trillion worth of so-called nuclear modernization?
President Obama was putting the New START treaty with Russia before the Congress in 2010. President Obama is an earnest abolitionist. His hand was forced in order to get the New START treaty approved, enacted, to bring the nuclear arsenals down yet further. He did agree to what I would call the first stage of there's a difference between maintenance and effective upkeep of the nuclear arsenal and reinvention of it. It's alas true that under the Obama administration, the ground was laid for the reinvention. But I'm certain that if President Trump were not elected president, that reinvention wouldn't have happened. The point is, it is happening. The missile silos in North Dakota have been reinvented, recommitted to, and so forth.
Don't go away. I want to introduce Gene Gilliman, scientist, anthropologist, historian based at MIT. Gene, you're the bearer of another awful slice of history, and back to 1945 or thereabouts, and it still echoes the worst of Japanese germ warfare, war crimes in China before Pearl Harbor, crimes that the U.S. helped cover up when World War II was over. The Tokyo trials did not go anything like as far as the Nuremberg trials, and nuclear weapons have something to do with it, and we'll get to it, but I want to know, what is Japan making? They're sort of the odd man out in this Singapore summit. What are they saying about some...
Yes, it's almost unbelievable to think of Japan as the odd man out. And I think that historically what we're looking at is a revision of the entire map of East Asia. So if you went back to 1945, you would see China's devastated by war. Japan has been bombed to cinders. The North and South Korea are extremely poor, and actually the North is being occupied by the Soviet forces. So you see a kind of a devastation, but also for the United States, an opportunity, because the British Empire has collapsed, the French Empire has collapsed, the Dutch Empire has collapsed, and who's left standing is the United States. And are they going to move in? Yes, they're going to move in. And why are they going to move in? Because the Soviet Union, again, if you look at the map, extends all the way over to the Sea of Japan. It is looming right over Korea, looming right over Japan. And the United States is not going to stand for that. And the Soviet Union has also demonstrated in 1945, right after the bombing of Hiroshima, that it will try to expand into Manchuria, it will expand into Korea, and the United States is very much ill at ease with that. In fact, there are maps before the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki which have targets on the Soviet Union for nuclear bombing. It goes back that early, so it's actually before the famous Hiroshima-Nagasaki bombings.
Am I clear, though, about what the inhibition of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki amounted to in those trials? What was the was it we were biting our tongue on holding fire or what on the truth of that miserable mid-century?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because at the Tokyo Tribunal, the defendants had lawyers who raised the bombings, the nuclear bombings, and said the United States has committed a war crime. This was the slaughter of 200,000 people. How can you stand there and not have the person who made that decision here prosecuted? And they're talking about President Truman, by the way, at that point. So it's there in the background, but the judge who's in charge at that point, an Australian, says, we'll have no more talk of that. We'll have no more talk of that. So, but it's there.
So interesting. It's not an entirely implausible charge, war crime. I mean, why not? If it had been planting plague through birds and bats, and as the Japanese did in China, that's a war crime.
That is a war crime, and it was acknowledged as a war crime with the Geneva Convention in 1925. So that was not even an issue. But look at the innovation that a nuclear weapon is. I mean, nobody had a concept for understanding it, except that it was the ultimate total war weapon. So when you have that and you have civilian death, well, you're going to have to think about that. You're going to have to work that out. But in our frame of reference, the Soviet Union was an existential threat, because it's not just the intrusion into Asia, it's the intrusion into Europe. So Churchill is going to give his famous speech about the Iron Curtain. That comes very early. That's 1946. So everybody's looking at the Soviet Union as a force that the United States globally has to counter. And what the United States does is really interesting, because it replicates the empires. It takes over the lands that the others abandoned, if you will. So it has struggles. It can't take them all over. It can't take over India. You know, there are places where it can't become the new empire, but it tries very hard. And economically, there's not even a question. It is the new empire. And by the way, just add one thing, I think it's over. I think the United States, as that 1945 force that was going to come into Asia or come into other parts of the world and be the new empire, the new Western white empire, I think that's what we're looking at. I think we're looking at this withdrawal, which Trump is actually bringing to fruition, and people like it. Now, I don't know where it will go. I don't know how far it will go. But it looks to me like we're withdrawing from that old model.
Jim, who in our part of the world had the nerve to call the nuclear weapons a war crime? And how, talk about resetting our heads in the late 40s. How would you describe it?
Nuclear physicists who opposed the move from the atomic bomb to the hydrogen bomb in the early 1950s, after the Soviets exploded their own atomic bomb in 1949, dubbed the hydrogen bomb the genocidal weapon. Richard Rose can describe this. There was a knowledge early on that this weapon, especially the move to the hydrogen bomb, again, Richard Rose can explain it far better than I, but the explosive escalation of destructive power in the hydrogen bomb meant that there was only one possible meaning of the use of this weapon, which was the mass killing of human beings. So any notion, romantic notion of distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants, between soldiers and civilians, was completely out the window. Now, practically speaking, that was out the window anyway, especially in Japan, in terms of the American air campaign against Japan even before the atomic bomb. But it was very clear to a whole range of people that this weapon is a thing apart.
It was very, well, very commonly accepted. I mean, you think of Linus Pauling, you think of Bertrand Russell. People were with them morally for the judgment of nuclear weapons as genocidal. But the problem was this. For states, it was the currency of power. And it was very hard to work that out. So you have the currency of power on one side, and we don't want to let that go. France doesn't want to let it go. UK doesn't want to let it go. Other places, they don't want to let it go.
It's interesting.
Israel.
The racial complications are as ugly and worse, really, than the imperial connotations. Donald Trump himself, by calculation or not, told one of the Republican senators, don't worry about, in the heat of the threats on North Korea a year ago, was saying, in so many words, don't worry about the casualties. They'll be over there, not over here. Which is to say, they will not be white complexion. There will be something else. And it was a shock. And people of color everywhere, including black folk in this country, heard it immediately.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was very clear. The racism was there, no question.
The savage bombing by American forces in World War II is what set in motion, I believe, this Niagara current of amoral militarism. We lost the capacity to rein in our weaponry, our use of it. We lost the capacity or even the concern for the distinction between civilians and combatants. And we're still in the grip of this. Mm. It's a current that runs below the surface of American power.
But it surely runs significantly in the United Nations consensus against nuclear weapons and for abolition thereof. Third world against the old imperial club. Stand by. Coming up, the long view of the present day from the master historian Richard Rhodes, historian of the age that began in his Pulitzer Prize winner, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, and then his Arsenals of Folly about the arms race, and then the twilight of the bombs, where we may be stuck. This is Open Source. Richard Rhodes has written the whole nuclear saga to universal praise, from dawn to twilight. Richard Rhodes, welcome, and thank you for standing by. What comes after the twilight?
Well, we hope some kind of dawn. By the way, your previous guests, your continuing guests, have spoken great wisdom. I've been listening with fascinated ears.
Well, they read it all in your books.
No.
React, if you will, in a general way, just as a citizen, to the Singapore summit.
Well, let me first just say something about your just immediately previous discussion.
Please.
One of the terrible ironies of the whole progress of war. In 1943, the United States and Great Britain were deeply concerned that the Soviet Union would sign a separate peace treaty with Hitler and with Germany. And they were not ready to put troops on the ground in Europe, as Stalin had to in vast numbers and was losing lives. I think the Soviets lost 20 million lives in the Second World War.
At least.
The answer that we found was to bomb. And we hoped to bomb, we at least, the Americans hoped to bomb with great accuracy the factories that were making the German war materials. But for reasons I won't bother people with, we didn't have a bomb site that could accurately do that. And we were bombing 5 miles outside of town when we were trying to hit that factory. So we rationalized that if you're going to kill factory workers in the factory, then there's nothing wrong with killing them in their apartments and their houses. Now, that was the beginning of the area bombing, the so-called strategic bombing. And it was basically triggered by a concern that we might be facing Hitler's hordes alone in the West. So it's not as if we were simply being vicious and brutal. We had reason to be afraid ourselves of the course of the war. And once we'd made that decision in Europe, it was no great extension to decide that to protect our men from having to invade the Japanese home islands, which was considered to be something that would lead to great loss of life, that we would be better off burning down Japanese cities from the air. So it wasn't simply people making immoral decisions. It was the kind of relentless logic of war that I think originally led us to move to area bombing. And then, of course, with the atomic bombs, which, by the way, our State Department and our leadership in the immediate years after the war did not consider to be decisive weapons. The weapons that were used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were small by modern standards, of course, and they didn't produce more destruction than a comparable raid of firebombs with 1,000 B-29s. So once again, we were deceived by the technology to a degree to think that we had to accumulate a vast arsenal of these weapons in order to really be safe.
Mm.
So to move on to the summit, if you'd
please.
Like to.
Yeah.
You know, I find this really very hopeful because the background of North Korea's search for a new patron when it lost the patronage of the Soviet Union has been pointed, as Bruce Cummings said in the article you quoted earlier, has been a continuous ever since at least the 1970s. Most people don't realize that during the Korean War, our Strategic Air Command, under Curtis LeMay, basically bombed, as he often said, bombed North Korea back to the Stone Age.
Right.
We burned out 90% of all their cities. We ran out of targets in terms of urban targets and started bombing the vast dam structure that both provided the hydropower for the electricity supply, but also, and more horribly, held back the waters for the agricultural rice paddies in the valleys below. One of our dam-busting flights actually released water that swept out a 27-mile stretch of valley below the dam with all the people thereby. And the war against North Korea was the first where more civilians were killed than combatants. So it's not surprising that the North Koreans had a kind of concern for the United States overlooking their country. They also wanted to find someone who would support them in a world where they told Robert Gallucci, one of our negotiators, we're just little shrimps in a world of whales.
Talk about not knowing our history and not knowing who we're dealing with, as if this could have been forgotten by the North Vietnamese. And
right.
and Bruce Cummings is fascinating on this point. One of our great all-time reporters, David Halberstam, virtually left it out of his revision history of the Korean War. So there we are, stumbling into ourselves all the time. I'd love your thought, though, Richard, on lost opportunities. We're talking about, you know, nuclear disarmament. We count the near disasters, but what about the near miracles of waking up and doing something about these
weapons? Are you speaking now of Korea? Or
No. I'm thinking from 1945 on.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid we were so concerned about Russia, Soviet Union, in the immediate years after the war. And in this wise, as long as we had the bomb and the Soviet Union did not, but has still had most of its forces on the ground in Eastern Europe, there was in everyone's mind, I think, even Edward Teller's, as it turns out, a sense that there was a kind of balance of forces. But when the Soviet Union tested its first bomb in August 1949, much earlier than almost everyone expected it would be capable of doing, the balance of forces was then upset. And the rush by the hawks in Washington and in the scientific community was then to somehow acquire a new special capability. And in their eyes, that was the hydrogen bomb. And, of course, that was really bitterly fought out among the scientists, among government leaders. But the military, basically, which is where Truman turned for the final say in the matter, the military said, well, of course, if there's a distinctive new weapon, we should have it. Not thinking, I think, in terms of... I think one of the hardest problems down the years has been for people to realize just how immensely destructive nuclear weapons are.
Yeah.
And remember, this was long before anyone had conceived of the idea that there would be a nuclear winter effect from any even medium-scale nuclear war.
What opportunity was missed at the end of the Cold War, 1989?
You know, this is where George H.W. Bush really reacted well. He moved, for example, to pull our nuclear weapons out of Korea. Of course, understanding that we had them on submarines and ships just offshore, as it were. But still, as a gesture of goodwill, that was quite remarkable. And there was a general pulling back on both sides. I mean, on all sides, really. The new republics of the former Soviet Union returned their weapons to Russia and joined the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. There was a general cooling off that was not loved by people like Dick Cheney when he was Secretary of Defense in the later 90s, the hawks in Washington really didn't like the idea that we would somehow not have an enemy. You know, there's a wonderful comment by our Secretary of State in that period, who said, "I'm running out of enemies. I'm down to, let's see, one of the Middle Eastern dictators and Kim Il-sung," which to him was just about as small as you could get.
And now, what about the Bill Clinton's last Secretary of Defense, and his name is slipping me at the moment, Bill Perry. Still among us, who made a push?
Well, I think Perry is one of the great undersung heroes of this era. Perry is the one, as head of an Advanced Research Projects Agency, before he became Secretary of Defense, who devised our whole modern smart weapons programs.
As well as the Internet, right?
No.
Wasn't that DARPA?
Well, it was DARPA, but not when he was there.
Okay.
It was before then. But the point is, he was clearly moving toward a kind of weaponry that would be smart and that therefore would exchange accuracy for blast and that therefore would open the world to the possibility of eliminating nuclear weapons.
I'm sure
it wouldn't really be usable under these circumstances.
Richard Rhodes, I'm sure Gene Gilliman and Jim Carroll probably have questions for you, but I want one quick one. What about Chaz Freeman's point that part of the moral of the Singapore summit is if you don't want the United States to step on you, if you want to get their attention, you better get yourself a nuke. I mean, what's the future of that rather dangerous model?
You know, that model's really been around since the beginning, I think.
But this guy's pulled it off. Gaddafi couldn't, but this guy did.
He pulled it off with the most remarkable move back and forth between the threat and the open hand. And I hope that things follow up from here. One of the things that Ambassador Freeman said that struck me as an answer I'd been looking for is how would he denuclearize? Under what circumstances could he denuclearize? I mean, it was John Bolton who reminded everybody of what happened to Gaddafi after Libya denuclearized, and I don't suppose he said that accidentally. I suppose he was warning North Korea off. But in fact, if North Korea can find accommodation with South Korea, that is a context whereby it would be possible for it to denuclearize, and I had not thought of that before. I think that's a brilliant insight.
The best part of this whole summit was the scowl on John Bolton's face from beginning to end. He looked miserable all the time. But Jim Carroll, what's to learn here about a disarmament campaign today?
Well, you know, listening to Richard Rhodes, which is always a deep pleasure in reading him. Richard, greetings to you.
Thank you.
Can leave you with the impression that the world is a reasonable place because Richard is so reasonable.
Not in this hour.
And Richard has just laid out some of the most reasonable understandings of these complicated events. I would just step sideways to another reality, which is, especially when you're talking about nuclear weapons, reason takes second place to a dynamic that is itself irrational. That's what, in my view, the last 70 years teaches us, that there are ways in which these weapons have a life, a moral life of their own. From 1950 to 1960, and I think I may have originally seen this bit of data in Richard's work, the United States nuclear arsenal went from a few hundred to 19,000 nuclear warheads in one decade when the Soviet Union was not remotely challenging us at that level. Why did that happen? It partly happened because Curtis LeMay, to whom Richards referred, was the dominant nuclear force at that time. But it happened because there was an irrational dynamic at work in the American military imagination. This is what Eisenhower was warning against in 1960 when he left office.
Although those 19,000 weapons came about under Eisenhower.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Eisenhower presided over it. That, and
exactly.
he saw what had happened under his watch. And he understood this was insane. There was no way 19,000 nuclear weapons made any, most of them hydrogen bombs, made any rational sense. And that dynamic is still at work with us. And that's what's terrifying. That was what was terrifying about last summer, because we had the sense that suddenly we were back at the mercy of a dynamic that no one was in charge of. And of course, the truth is, no one is in charge of this. So we shouldn't be complacent at this moment.
No way.
About a signal of stepping back from the precipice. The precipice is still there.
I'd like to argue that there is another irrational dynamic that has operated in parallel with the one you're speaking of. And that is the really deep emotional existential fear at the most gut level of actually using a nuclear weapon, even a little one. The military has spun out all sorts of different kinds for different uses. Isn't it interesting that since 1945, no one has actually set one off in anger? I mean, there have been close calls. There have been all sorts of near misses, the Cuban Missile Crisis being the most obvious. But no one has actually done that. And that, to me, tells me something about where these weapons are in the imagination of even the most militaristic people.
Gene Gilliman,
I have a great hope here, Richard. pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I have a great hope that nuclear weapons and chemical weapons and biological weapons will all land up in some dump, the dump of the 20th century total war theory, where they belong. I don't think anybody wants a total war right now. Or ever. I mean, and that's what these are about. And I use that expression, the currency of power. They become the currency of power. But if you step back from that, the use issue is really paramount. Nobody wants to use them. And there would be such terrible repercussions. We thank Lynn Eden, for example, and others for alerting us, years ago, for what does it mean? It means incineration, and it means a general demolition of an entire environment. Do we want that?
Yeah.
Well, I want to just scream here that usability is, of course, what is central to the notion of the Nuclear Posture Review that was issued last winter by the Pentagon. The nuclear hawks have been empowered in recent years, certainly in recent months. And they talk in the Nuclear Posture Review of last February about, quote, low-yield weapons to give the commander-in-chief, quote, flexibility to make these weapons usable. That's exactly what's at work here. Something is horribly wrong with the way in which American military strategists are thinking about nuclear weapons right now. For a generation, the silo ICBM project has been understood to be obsolete and to be eliminated. Last summer, it was renewed. There are new contracts out for silos in North Dakota. Richard, am I wrong?
Well, the idea of a small, easily usable nuke has truly been around since the 1950s. Los Alamos has been pushing to build such a device, I think because they think it's just such a neat little gadget that they would love to see in our arsenal. But notice, the idea that these are somehow a sort of gold in our Fort Knox, which is, I think, what we were just talking about, is a terrible, frightening idea. But it seems to me that's pretty much what they've become. And within that framework, the military loves to think about new ways to coin new coins, but we don't use them. Even under circumstances like 9/11, when I really did hold my breath, I thought, God, if this is ever a time when George Bush might nuke something, this would be it. Fortunately, there was no target.
At the risk of being childish and sentimental, I also just got a note. In these moments, as in Reykjavik, you just feel an unbelievable hunger out there and in here for peace, for justice, for respect in the world. How's to mobilize it? That's the next program. We'll get to it. Thank you, Gene Gilliman, Jim Carroll, and the amazingly prolific Richard Rhodes, whose new book is called Energy, A Human History. I don't know how you do it, Richard. Thanks also to Chaz Freeman. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Donay, and the artist Susan Coyne. Paul Kalo's our engineer. Mary McGrath is our queen. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.